Madeleine Tien's third novel, Do Not Say We Have Nothing, is an epic tale told across two generations of a Chinese family, one who lived through Mao's Cultural Revolution and the children who survived it. The book, which was shortlisted for this year's Man Booker Prize, is published by Norton. I'm very pleased it has brought Madeleine Tien to our show. Hello.
Hello.
And we'll get to the significance of our playing Glenn Gould from a little bit of Glenn Gould and the Goldberg variations in a while. But I'm interested in about some of your past work. Your last novel, Dogs at the Perimeter, was about the Cambodian genocide in the 1970s. And this one is set in a similar time, but in China. Are you just going to specialize in Asian countries? Is there something in Thailand that you want to write about next?
There is something in Japan, actually, but in this case, it was the novels. Both novels track from Cambodia, China, America, Canada, and elsewhere. And for me, it was more about writing about political events in my lifetime and to my generation. So that's where it all began. And I was tracking a series of ideas from Cambodia, Pol Pot's Cambodia. And the way that Marxism and socialism manifested in Asian countries, and I was ended up tracking it back to Mao.
Also, the interaction between Western cultures and Asian cultures. Your parents are Malaysian Chinese. Is that a typical combination?
I think it is, it was. I think Malaysia is changing very fast, but there was a lot of the Chinese diaspora in Malaysia. My father was born in what was then British North Borneo, became Malaysia. And so I think it's relatively common, yeah.
Did you travel to China to prepare for this book?
Yes, many times. I first went in 2002 without any intention to write about it. I was doing a journey that my mother had wanted to make, and she passed away before she could do it. So I was sort of doing the trip she had imagined. And then I returned again for a few months in 2008, and after that I just couldn't stop going back. It's such a vast, immense, complicated place.
Are people open about their family histories during this time that you write about?
It's not the first subject that you would open with someone.
Are they still suspicious, and do they still worry that somebody might find out that they have complained about things?
I think it depends what it is. If it's certain issues that are of the moment, especially any criticism of the high-ranking Communist Party leaders, I think it's very unlikely that you're going to hear that, except in a sort of sideways kind of way. But in terms of talking about the past or about talking about Mao, I think there is a lot of openness, but in some ways, no sense of how to talk about it, because the country has transformed so quickly.
So it's very different from the country you're writing about here? Although some things linger, censorship, but perhaps not as invidiously as it was back then.
I think a lot is similar. I think a lot of mechanisms are still very similar, and I think the power relationship is similar, and that's without discounting the tremendous progress and development that has happened in China.
Li Ling, one of your characters here, whose English name is Marie, starts the story by saying, "In a single year, my father left us twice, the first time to end his marriage and the second when he took his life." She's only 10 years old when her father dies. Would she have known him?
It's a question that she's asking for most of this novel. You know, how much do we know the people we love, or even how much do we know the people who loved us? I think it is the impetus of this novel is the piecing together, but in
a family history,
but in an almost magical realist way. It combines different ways of storytelling. But it is very much about unofficial Chinese history. What cannot be contained in what we really can call official memory in Chinese history, and what is part of a realm of political catastrophe that I think many in power would prefer to forget.
She lives in Vancouver, which has a sizable Chinese population. Are they keeping a a kind of a foreign China going there?
No, I don't think
they become Canadian?
Well, in this case, she only speaks English. Her mother speaks Cantonese and her father Mandarin.
Which is three very different languages.
Three very different languages. And so part of the struggle is also the piecing together of the learning of the language and the decoding of the language in certain ways. But in her case, she is she's a mathematician. She loves the notations of language. And she's... This is also the 80s, so that's a different migration history. It's quite different from now, where there's more migration from mainland China.
There's a whole section on writing down things and writing down the transcribing books for yourself, sometimes even changing them a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that is typical among Chinese intellectuals?
It was in that period of time, much in the way that it was in Russia, with the passing of documents and samizdat. Exactly. And in this case, it's a set of notebooks called the Book of Records that, for which the author has been lost and doesn't seem to have a beginning or an end. And it becomes a sort of coded novel in which things are hidden and in which they learn to code themselves into it so that they can find each other as, political campaigns intensify and people are scattered.
So you had to come up with a book within a book.
It's a book within a book. It's an open-ended book. I think that's the important part. In this, it's a mirror of history, that it is still an ongoing historical moment.
And there's another main character is Ai Ming. Why does Marie's mother take her in?
Ai Ming is a 19-year-old student. She becomes caught up in the 1989 Tiananmen demonstrations. She chooses to leave her country. She ends up taking shelter with this family in Vancouver. And through Ai Ming, we learn about Ai Ming's father and Marie's father, who are both musicians. And they were both musicians at the Shanghai Conservatory of Music in the 1960s until the Cultural Revolution overturned their lives.
So that's why we opened with Bach's Goldberg Variations, played by Glenn Gould, who of course is a Canadian. What's the significance of that piece to Ai Ming's father, who has the name Sparrow?
Yes. His mother gives him what she thinks of as a weak name so that the gods will overlook him and he might survive difficult times.
Sparrow. Just a little sparrow.
A little sparrow. It's a piece of music that he loves. He has a deep affiliation with Bach, and in particular the Goldberg Variations, and this idea that the simple motif that opens the variations, the aria, has a very, very simple motif that's then reworked into 30 variations and canons, which traverse vast expanses of human emotion that we don't have names for even or words for, until we return to the same aria at the end but have in some ways crossed a universe.
I'm speaking with Madeline Tien, T-H-I-E-N. Her latest novel is Do Not Say We Have Nothing. It is published by Norton. Western classical music was definitely part of the curriculum for music students throughout modern Chinese history. Did that all end with the Cultural Revolution?
No, it did temporarily. But even during the Cultural Revolution, there was official music. So certain composers were forbidden, but certain composers were allowed.
Western composers?
Yes, so certain of Beethoven's works were still allowed and so on. And there was still a Central Philharmonic in Beijing under Madame Mao.
But there was also a lot of revolutionary, Western-sounding, martial-sounding music, but that was with a Chinese sensibility.
Flavor
to it.
Almost, yeah, that's right. It was a kind of expanded orchestra that could bring in traditional Chinese instruments as well as what we know in the Western classical orchestra.
What was Mao trying to accomplish when he shut down cultural centers like the Shanghai Conservatory of Music?
The Cultural Revolution, you know, on the surface was about regaining control of the communist revolution. So the idea was that there were forms of art and literature that needed to be purged from society because they carried the old values. And in carrying the old values, they were giving rise to counter-revolutionary kinds of thought. So this was calligraphy, painting, Western classical music, Chinese traditional music, literature, and so on, all many forms of art, and even into the academic sphere as well. Old forms of learning, received ideas. The idea was that you needed to destroy all those so that we could begin again with a purity of heart to make a pure revolution.
And intellectuals became objects of suspicion.
And danger, and of poison. This idea that they were poisoning the minds of the young, that they were distracting them with sort of bourgeois pleasures, you know, from the real work that had to be done.
Sparrow has written a symphony, his symphony number 3, which was destined to be his greatest piece, but he struggles to finish it.
Yes.
Because of the turmoil around him?
I think it's something I felt, you know, with the last book. What I felt was the failure of words in the face of human catastrophe, and I think what Sparrow feels is the failure of music, of not knowing how to use the language of music to express the complications of the society in which he finds himself, and in fact being forbidden from doing so and not having the courage to do it regardless. I'm not being able to pay that price. And so he destroys this music that is within himself. And I think part of Sparrow's trajectory in his life is what happens when you destroy that thing that is most precious to yourself. Is it even possible to bring it back, or is that piece of music gone forever? He never finishes it. He has this idea that, in fact, it cannot be finished because the lives that it revolved around no longer exist.
Julie Sparrow's cousin was a concert violinist at the time of the Cultural Revolution, very talented. Why was she living with Sparrow, and what had happened to her parents?
Yes. She has two parents. Her parents, when the
Most
dreamer
of us
a
have
poet.
Two parents.
Yes, it's true. I was thinking of how she actually becomes parented by her aunt and uncle, because her parents are sent to labor camps in an earlier purge during what's called the anti-rightist movement. And many of these labor camps were in the northwest in the desert regions, and they're taken away when she's relatively young, and she's taken into the home of her aunt and uncle, who are musicians, and she discovers that this music feels like the essence of the voice she was born with.
How aware were people in other Chinese communities outside of China of what was going on, the excesses of the Cultural Revolution? Were they able to hear about it from the people who were going through it, some of whom believed in it with all their hearts?
I think the information slipped out, but it was very hard to get in and out of China at that time. I've heard stories of people who swam to Hong Kong, and all this incredible stories like this. But you know, up until the moment when Nixon came into China, when Pierre Trudeau came into China, it had sort of closed itself off from the world not long after the Sino-Soviet split. So it's interesting with China, because at that time it wasn't quite a billion people. It was maybe 600, 700 million. But it is a universe on its own. It was a world unto itself. And
well, so the regions are all so different,
so
and people
different.
Speak different languages.
Exactly, exactly. I think that's why this push to harmony, to having, you know, one sort of harmonic belief system is such a powerful idea in China.
This is a novel with a lot of plot, so we can't get to it all. But congratulations for being shortlisted for the Man Booker.
Yes, thank you so much.
Sorry you didn't win it.
Oh,
but,
well,
but
I
Paul
love
Beatty,
the book, that one.
Paul Beatty was a guest on our show recently, and
I'm a huge
we
fan
loved
of
his
Paul
book.
Beatty, yes.
Madeleine Tien's book is Do Not Say We Have Nothing. It is published by Norton, and I'm assuming you're at work at another one?
I am at the beginnings of another one.
Well, I look forward to seeing you when you've published that one.
Thank you so much.